Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I have this strong view that we don't know very much, that basically we're all pea brains. The Bodleian Library at Oxford University has 130 miles of shelf space. If you go to get a book there, you fill out a reader's ticket, and they pride themselves that they can have the book for you within 24 hours. If you go to the Widener Library at Harvard University, there's 19 million books under that one roof. With all this knowledge that's out there shelved and cataloged, who's read all that stuff? We make judgments all the time, and we know so little. Have you read all the books at your local library, for example? Forget that. Have you read all the books on your own shelves at your home? We know so little. And I look at culture, and I don't know very much about culture. I've been around, I don't know, I've been to 50-some countries over the years, and I think I made my 123rd crossing of the oceans on my way here. I've had great privilege for that, but again, every time you go and look at a culture and so on, you perceive that there's so little you actually know. And I've noticed about culture things like this. In the English-speaking cultures, for example, we have no way, except by some contrived convention, to articulate the difference between a singular you and a plural you. I've wondered if it was affected by our geography, because all of the English-speaking countries are basically islands. I mean, North America is a continent. We have Mexico to our south, but you can drive from Florida to Nome, Alaska, and speak English the whole way. And we're isolated from the rest of the world. We've been isolated from many of the great wars and stuff like that. And I've often wondered if our geography isolating us has us thinking more individualistic. England is an island. Ireland's an island. Australia's an island. New Zealand's a couple of islands. Maybe South Africa would be the anomaly, but English is one of 34 national languages there. If you look at American history and American, you know, they say Australia was a penal colony. So every time I meet somebody from Australia, I say the difference between your progenitors and mine is that mine could run faster than yours. They didn't get caught. but the Americans, when they arrived, the Europeans, when they arrived on the East Coast, they felt it was their manifest destiny to conquer that continent. And they prided themselves in their individualism. So their geography, their language, and now the way they forged their sense of self based on their arrival there affected their culture deeply. There was a man named Alfred Kazin who wrote the book, An American Procession. And he believed the defining moment in American literature was when Ralph Waldo Emerson stood up in his pulpit, renounced his Trinitarian theology. That sounds like an individualistic thing to do. Renounced his Trinitarian theology and declared himself a Unitarian. And Kazin then, beginning with that point of individualism, goes to the next generation of literary figures, Emily Dickinson, and says that our literature then drifted towards subjectivism. The next generation, Henry Adams and Mark Twain, drifted towards cynicism, and the next generation, Hemingway, drifted towards nihilism. You'll find that same development, by the way, in one generation in Nietzsche. So Nietzsche could do in one generation what it took us Americans four generations to do. We're a little slow on the uptake. But nevertheless, this individualism, and yet, most U's in the New Testament, in the Greek, are plural. The Bible's supposed to be understood in community. You want to preach the gospel to an English-speaking person, you have to break through the veneer of that cultural individualism. How do you do that? How do you cultivate humility in the heart of a person who thinks we can make it on our own? I have students from Asia often. I had many students from Japan years ago, and they were going to go back to Japan and do ministry, and they were wrestling with their culture. And they said their culture was an honor-based culture. And in an honor-based culture, you don't want to admit that you've done something wrong because it would bring shame to your family or your culture. So to say to somebody that they have to acknowledge that they're a sinner, or as Frederick Buechner says, before the gospel could ever be good news, it has to be bad news. How do you break through that cultural veneer in order to get a person to the place where they'd be willing to say with humility, I have a deep need for God? Well, at the heart of the Christian message is the message that God loves us deeply, and that God's love is fundamental to anything we would ever hope to be. Our identity is at some level, if it's going to be a good identity, wrapped up in receptivity to the love of God. The individualist, he doesn't think he needs that. And the honor-based person doesn't want to admit that maybe they've done something wrong whereby forgiveness, which is an attribute of the love of God, would be necessary. There's something that requires humility if we are going to engage properly with the deep love of God. And yet, interestingly enough, when Jesus was asked, what's the most important thing I can do with my life? He said, love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, all your mind. He says, the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, John makes it clear in his epistle that our love for God is reflective. We love because he first loved us. God is the sun, we are the moon. We reflect back to him what we sense we've received from him. And we reflect to others that which we have received from him. But our tendencies sometimes in our culture, while they provide us much great good and show signs of great human creativity, they also generally in a fallen world provide some things that can be impediments to the gospel. So I want us to consider this whole thing about the love of God. I think it's important too. In the Pensée, Pascal made this observation. The Christians have two laws better than all the laws of statecraft. Love God, love your neighbor. I don't need the law to tell me to respect your property if I am loving God and loving my neighbor. I will have an inherent inclination towards that, an intrinsic desire to want to do that which would be respectful of you. I had never been to Athens till 3 years ago, and I've been there the last 3 years. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. It's a city full of graffiti. But I was shocked to discover Athens was the most graffitied city I had ever seen in my life. And the irony for me is, what would it take for you to say, your property means nothing to me, and I have no problem taking a can of paint and painting over that which is yours? You come out, you're aghast at this, so you whitewash it over, and the next day it's painted over again. You whitewash it again, and it's painted over again, and finally you just give up, and it's a city that's given up in that respect. And yet this was the city in ancient days when people understood that you had to have order for society, that the order was always imposed, it was extrinsic. You had oligarchies, a rule by few, plutarchies, a rule by the rich, maybe a tyranny, somebody assumes power and won't let go, maybe a monarchy comes down through lineages and so on. And finally in Athens, they said, let's see if we could try some sort of rule whereby people could have liberty and will still manage order in our culture. And they tried democracy, and it worked for about 80 years. But what happened was the democracy and the liberty diminished into license. Milton, in his great sonnet number 12, said, liberty they cry, liberty when all they wanted was license. And there's always the risk that this could happen. What makes the difference? How does the humility of recognition of human lack of independence, human dependence, we are dependent creatures, we are pea brains, we don't know much. There's certain levels of weakness that are really characteristic of what it means to be human. How do we cultivate that humility that avails us of the love of God, that causes us to have the intrinsic motivation to walk in light of that love and then to exhibit that love to others? And I think this is very significant, and I do think love and humility are combined. If you have lack of love of God and lack of love of others, what happens is that penal codes begin to thicken and proliferate and fill shelves and fill law libraries, because you have to develop extrinsically what should be a normal proclivity if we knew the love of God and so on. So I want to talk about this. What does the love of God mean for Christians day after day? I have several small groups I lead at Wheaton College of Students. I have about 44 students in different small groups. And this last year, the first semester of school, with each small group, all we did was discuss what would it mean if you knew and you knew well that you were loved by God unconditionally, with a love that's ontological, right? That's a good college word, isn't it? Ontology, the study of being in existence. That essential to God's nature is His love. That means His love is not diminished by our poor performance, nor is it improved by our good performance. God's love is constant. It may show different faces. If I'm flat on my face, His love will not abandon me, but neither will He let me lay there. He reproves and disciplines. He picks up and He nurtures. He encourages. He transforms, and sometimes that transformation can have some painful processes, right? Every son loved by his father is reproved and disciplined. But what would it mean if you were convinced of the love of God? For a whole semester, that's all we discussed. Now, try it sometime with one of your small groups at church and go for weeks and weeks and start writing down the kinds of things you discover. It's really remarkable. Anyway, in light of this, most of my academic work is on C.S. Lewis. Most of my publications, I think I have 5 books on Lewis and numerous articles and chapters and other books and stuff like that. And I like C.S. Lewis, and he's been very helpful to me as a person. He opens more than wardrobe doors. I don't just read him for his children. I've read all of his books. There's 73 books. I've read them all over and over again. The literary criticism is his best stuff, but most people don't read that material. But you read Lewis, and then he'll talk about some book, and you'll go read that book, and then you'll go read another book, and then you'll go read another book. So I try and read the books he refers to, too. He opens more than wardrobe doors. But I don't always agree with him. And I'm going to tell you one place where I don't agree with him. C.S. Lewis said that he thought pride was the great sin. He writes about it in Mere Christianity. And when Lewis wrote about it, he wasn't the only one to express that. In his commentary on Psalm 19, Augustine says that he thinks also that pride is the great sin. So if I'm disagreeing with C.S. Lewis and Augustine, I'm probably wrong. But nevertheless, let me see if I can make a case as to what maybe is the great sin. And by the way, I was really pleased. I was rereading Calvin's Institutes last summer, and I found that actually Calvin holds my particular point of view. So if you're an Arminian here, you won't like anything I say this morning or this afternoon. But let's look at it like this. Had Lewis said that he thought that pride, like the apex of a pyramid, was the greatest point in that whole process, and he meant pride was the great sin in that regard, I could have signed on, but it would have meant things beneath would have been far more substantive. But when he and Calvin talk about pride, they talk about it as if it's the main spring from which all other sins are generated, or the axiom sin around which all other sins spin. Well, certainly we could say a lot of things can come from pride. I don't disagree with that. But is that the great sin? Is that the fundamental sin from which all other sins are really generated? And when I talk about pride, too, I'm not talking about pride of a job. Well done. You put in a lot of effort and you're pleased with the outcome. Or the pride you take when your child does something well. Or you see a friend succeed at something. I'm not talking about that kind of pride. I'm talking about pride that exhibits itself as something better than it is. Pride that looks like pretense and so on. And when I talk about this kind of pride, what precedes that? By the way, we can get to this in a lot of interesting ways. You could be at a church, and your church is well-meaning, but you marginalize some struggler who's fallen into sin. And while nobody would say it explicitly, implied in that is you've got to be perfect then in this community. Nobody is perfect, so it can breed a kind of pretense. How are you? I'm fine. I don't want to share what's going on in my heart. I saw what you did with the last guy. And so consequently, this can happen. I don't think it's peculiar to Christian organizations either. In America, I don't know how it is in your countries, but you watch one night of nightly news, and all the pontificators on the news and the talking heads will talk about some politician who went off the rails, or some businessman, or some Hollywood star, or something like that went off the rails. And they're talking about it as if they would never go off the rails, and everybody in the culture ends up, boy, you don't want to do anything wrong in this culture, or at least any wrong that anybody would know about. And it breeds a kind of pride and pretense and keeps people, I think, from honest community, and certainly keeps them from the kind of humility that could lead to something healthy and certainly dispose them to rush towards the love of God that gives grace. So what precedes this kind of pride that exhibits itself in pretense? What do you find when you get pretentious? Or should I just let down my guard completely here instead of trying to draw it out from you? Usually I'm afraid. There's some insecurity. If you knew me like I was, you might reject me. So it's usually driven by a kind of fear, I think. And if in fact it is driven by fear, if that's fair, then the Bible would begin to hint at what the great sin might be, because we read in 1 John 4:18 that perfect love casts out fear. Mature love casts out fear. If perfect love casts out fear, a corollary could be drawn from that, that imperfect love breeds anxiety. You and I have never been loved perfectly by another human being before. That means all of us at some level are saddled with a burden of anxiety. And it gets worse before it gets better, because you and I have never loved anybody perfectly. And people who are looking to us for love and security have also been saddled with a burden of anxiety. There's only one person who knows you utterly. And oh, people, he loves you completely. His love is ontological. There's some honesty that's bred. I believe honesty and humility are synonyms. There's an honesty that's bred by that love. We can look truthfully at ourselves as we are and not be afraid, because we know we're loved. And we can let that love seep deep even into those places where our lives are all messed up and need to be remade. And so I would suggest to you that the great sin is to live in neglect of God's love or in rejection of God's love. If you go back to the Garden of Eden, when the account is given in Scripture of the fall, Satan comes to the garden, and clearly Adam and Eve are well provided for. And they're told not to eat from this one tree. And the serpent says to the woman, this is root translation, right? That's a nice place God's put you here. But why did he hold back on this tree? Look at it. It's delight for the eyes. It's good for food, and it's desirable to make one wise. Why would he keep you from this? Matter of fact, if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to bless you. You're not going to be taken care of. So in a sense, he gets her to doubt whether or not God's going to take care of her. And doubting his love and provision, she then asserts her will. So the act of disobedience, you could call that maybe pride, she's asserting her will over God's. And he even says to her, in the day you eat of this tree, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God. There's arrogance there. But it's prompted by this sense of not believing she's loved by God. It's amazing, if I believe I'm loved by God, how that could even cultivate courage in my Christian life. I think there was something about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael were their Israel names, their Jewish names. But they even said to Nebuchadnezzar, we know God can rescue us, but whether he rescues us or not, we will not bow down. There's somebody who has confidence that whether or not God wants to rescue them, they will be in step with God's provision. It's a triumphant sense of his love, a transcending love, a love that even extends beyond the grave. So anyway, I want to maybe give an illustration about this, if I can. Years ago, I was on an airplane, and I saw a movie. And I hate to recommend movies I see on airplanes, because I don't know if they've been sanitized. You know, you can say, oh, I saw this great movie, you got to see it, and then you find out that all the really sketchy parts were edited out, and you saw it on the plane, and people were saying, what were you thinking recommending that movie? You know, I remember one time I saw a movie like that, and I was working with a youth group, and I brought the youth group in, and I decided I'd show them the movie. I got the movie, I'm going, oh my heaven, I had to turn it off and ask forgiveness of the youth group and so on. But anyway, this movie I saw, I watched it, and C.S. Lewis said, if you read a book, well, you should think critically about the book. We don't want to live our lives with our minds inert. Nevertheless, don't think critically about the thing you're reading or the movie you're seeing until you've gotten the message first. You want to make sure that you've entered into the experience of the thing. And what I've found is if I'm a high T on the Myers-Briggs, if I get misty-eyed and start crying or something like that, I go, well, what was that about? And I want to go back when the movie's over and start thinking about it. If I find myself just falling down, rolling in laughter, I want to go back and say, what was it about that scene? Well, I was watching this movie on the airplane, and there was this one scene where all of a sudden I just burst into tears, sobs. And when the movie was over, I started saying, why did that affect me so deeply? Now, the movie I have in mind is The Notebook. Did any of you see that movie? Every time I mention it, if people have seen it, they laugh at me, they smile at me, because it's supposed to be a chick flick. And I just want you to know I'm secure enough in my masculinity that I can watch movies like that, it's okay. But this movie starts out when this old man comes to a nursing home. The old man is played by James Garner, and he walks up to this old woman, played by Gina Rowlands. And he starts to read her a story, and she's very standoffish, and the orderly at the hospital says, it's okay, he comes and reads stories every day. And the impression made is that this old man in his retirement goes to the rest home and volunteers his time to read stories to people who have dementia or something like that. And the whole movie is in present time, this old man reading the story to the old woman, and the flashback of the time of the story. And the story's set in a village in the south of the United States, actually a city or village not too far from Charleston, South Carolina. And there's a lake, and there's a young man who grew up in that town. And there's a family that's very wealthy that comes to summer in that town, and they have the means whereby they could summer there. And they have a daughter. And it seems like there's everything that counts against the relationship developing between this young man and this young woman. He has an education, he has a high school diploma, and he likes to read the poetry of Walt Whitman. But she has an education in all the best schools her parents' money can buy. Her family's intact. There's a mother, there's a father, and the daughter. His family, we don't know whatever happened to fracture it, but the father's there. But the mother's gone, and we don't know if she abandoned the family or if she died. There's been some sorrow. And economically, sociologically, there's so many things that count against it, but this relationship works. And it's a summer romance, and the parents of the girl are very concerned about it because they have plans for their daughter. And this is a disruption. And when the summer ends and they're pulling the two apart, the young boy yells out to the young girl, I will write to you every day. The mother hears it and she goes to the mailbox and intercepts the mail, and the girl never gets the letters. And one more thing counting against this relationship, she thinks he said he loved me and he would write every day, he never writes. And he writes every day and never hears back from her, and he still is faithful to his love for her. World War II breaks out, and now circumstances of time and condition cause these two to be ripped even further apart. And it's about this time in the movie, though, that you discover that this relationship does work. And it's at that moment in the movie that the director tips his hand and you realize it's this old man and this old woman's story. And he comes every day to read the story to his wife, to remind her. Towards the end of the movie, there's this scene where they're in the hospital. The day has come to an end. He's been reading to her all day. And there's a tablecloth on a nice table. They've had a nice dinner. There's a candle burning on the table. There's a rose and a bud vase. There's a record player playing all the music that had informed so much of their relationship. And the entire room is pulsating out to this woman, the love of this man for her. And he finishes the story after reading it all day. And she says to him, "That's the best love story I've ever heard in my life. And it sounds so familiar." And in that moment, cognition washes across her face. And she says, "It's our story, isn't it?" He said, "Yes." She says, "How much time do we have?" He said, "Last time it was 5 minutes. She says, "How are the children?" That's a question a mother would ask, isn't it? He said, "They're fine. They were here to see you today." She says, "Tell them I love them." He says, "I will." And then while the music's playing, she says, "Hold me. Can we dance?" And he takes her in his arms, and they begin to dance across that hospital floor. And as quickly as she came into cognition, she falls out of cognition and finds herself in the arms of a stranger and begins screaming. And as she screams, the orderlies have to come in and sedate her. And James Garner's character is standing, leaning against the wall, biting his knuckle, weeping. And when I saw him weeping like that, that's when I lost it. So what was it about that scene? As I thought about it more and more, I thought, you know what? This is all of our story. We're all part of a love relationship that has so many things counting against it. Looks like it'll never work. But the persistence of the one who loves us, he continues to tell us the story. He continues to pursue us with that ontological, unconditional love rooted in his nature. And there come those moments in our lives when all of a sudden we come to cognition and we recognize it. And then some little inconvenience occurs. Some little thing sets us off. And we fall out of cognition as quickly as we fall into cognition. And when I saw James Garner's character biting his knuckle, weeping, I thought I saw a window into the very heart of God. He loves us. And he loves us ontologically, with a love that leads to security, casts out fear, and removes the need for pretense. I'm learning to face the truth about myself, because I know that God loves me. Not face the truth about myself and say I'm content to leave it like I'm discovering, but instead facing the truth and recognizing that I want transformation. And there will be some humility that will require. But the love of God is a security whereby that kind of humility and honesty can emerge. So there's a text in 1 John 3:1-3 that I think gives us one of the best pictures of this kind of father love. As John writes, he's always calling his readers children. You know, I mean, they estimate he could have been around 90 years old. When you're that old, everybody's a child, right? So he says, "See how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us." 1 John 3:1-3. "See how great a love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God. And such we are. For this reason, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God. And it has not appeared as yet what we shall be. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope fixed upon him purifies himself just as he is pure." So let's see if we can take that passage apart a little bit. See how great a love the Father has bestowed upon me. I've had the privilege of working with college students most of my adult life. And part of that is because I became a Christian as a college student, and I just see the value of that age in investing in students. And in all my years I've worked with people, I have often run across people who have difficulty with the fatherhood of God passages of Scripture because they had a bad father figure. But for every 10 I've seen who had a bad father figure, maybe 1 out of 10 has problems with those passages. 9 out of those 10 long for those passages because they long for the vacuum, the father vacuum, to be filled by somebody like God the Father. They take to it like ducks to water. And here's this one passage, and it says, "I want you to see how great God's love is for you." I'm a father. I have 4 children. I have 13 grandchildren. The oldest is 6. At Christmas time, my wife and I have to decide, what are we going to do this year at Christmas? Are we going to buy the kids Christmas presents? Are we going to make the house payment? And we've decided we're going to move into a tent. Grandkids win. Grandkids win. You guys will be having grandkids pretty soon. You'll know. They've got their first child getting married in September, is it? September. So anyway, I have these 4 children, and I know that there have been times where I've made horrible mistakes with them. There have been other times where I feel like we've done pretty well. And sometimes it surprises me. My kids all love Jesus. They married people who love Jesus. They've all led people to Jesus, and they've nurtured people they've led to Jesus. So people they've led to Jesus have led other people to Jesus as well. And I worship Jesus for this because I know the mistakes I made. I remember years ago reading in the Bible where it said that Jesus learned obedience from the things he suffered. And I remember praying one time, Father, if your son had to suffer to learn and he was unfallen, I don't guess I'm getting a pass on suffering. But if you'll let me interject in the process, please don't let that suffering come from my children. Don't let them have to suffer because you need to teach me something. Now, I've met people who have had kids who have really gone off the rails. And I look at those parents and I think maybe the best gift God gave to those parents were parents like that who would love them even in difficult times. I've also met kids who are great, and maybe God gave those parents kids like that because the parents have gone off the rails. I don't think there's any formula whereby you could say, this happened because. I don't believe in karma on this sort of stuff. But I just prayed, Lord, if I could interject. I know I made mistakes with my children. I was asked last year to speak at a conference on family. And I said, okay, I'll do it on condition. I said, what's that? I said, my whole family has to be invited. And after every message I give, one of my family members has to give up and give their take on it. Because otherwise it's a pretense, right? We can all say anything we want about family. Any of us who have been fathers, any of us who have had fathers, know there are some things our fathers did that were well and some things our fathers did that were goofy. And any of us who have been fathers know there have been some things we've done well and some things we've done that are goofy. But this text says there's one father who always gets it right. And people, he loves you. He loves you. He loves you. It goes on to prove the point in the second verse. And it proves it this way. It says, one day we'll be like Christ. When he appears, we'll be like him. I don't believe it means we'll be like him in his deity ever, ever. You can't have the created become uncreated. We will never be rivals for him in our knowledge. We'll never be omniscient. If you know 0 to 100 bits about the infinite God, how much more is there still to know? An infinite amount, right? If you know 0 to 1,000 bits, how much more is there still to know? An infinite amount. If you know 0 to 1 billion bits, I don't think even in heaven we're ever going to get to the bottom of him. I think heaven is going to be a perpetual, mind-blowing experience that will always be taking our breath away. I remember the first year I became a Christian, I read through the Bible that year, and I got to the end, and it was amazing to me. I was overwhelmed with what the scripture said. It was so different than everything I had conceived. I'd been raised in a church, but never heard the gospel there. I was told if I went to a movie and Jesus came back, he wouldn't go in the theater to get me, I'd just go straight to hell. I wanted to see Walt Disney's The Shaggy Dog, but didn't know if it was worth risking my eternal destiny to go see. And when the neighbor lady, Mrs. Greenlee, I'm not embellishing, this happened just like this. When the neighbor lady, Mrs. Greenlee, came down and asked my mom if my brothers and I could go with her boys to see The Shaggy Dog, I'm looking at my mother with complete ambivalence. I want to see it on one hand, I'm afraid to go on the other hand. And when my mother said yes, I began to wonder if she really loved me, that she'd put my life in such eternal peril. And I deduced as a boy, having been told in Sunday school class, you do live a holy and perfect life, but if you have one bad thought the last second of your life, you're going straight to hell. And I deduced if I could lose it based on what I did, I had to gain it based on what I did. And man, talk about anxiety. And I just thought, I'm cooked. There's no hope for me. And it wasn't until I was in college that I heard the gospel that the God of the universe loved me and forgave me. And I was overwhelmed by that knowledge. And I responded to it. And I read through the Bible and then discovered everybody in the Bible was so messed up. Everybody could have introduced themselves in some sort of a recovery group, right? Hi, my name's Noah and I'm a drunk. Hi, my name's Miriam. And I'm jealous of my little brother Moses, and I'm a racist. I'm upset about his interracial marriage. Hi, my name's Aaron. I'm a religious leader, and I cave to peer pressure. Hi, my name's Moses. I'm a hothead and a murderer. Hi, my name is Naomi, and I'm bitter. Hi, my name's Samson, and I'm struggle with lust. Hi, my name's David. I'm an adulterer and a murderer. Hi, my name's Solomon. I'm supposed to be wise, but I'm really intemperate. Hi, my name's Elijah. I struggle with depression. Hi, my name's Peter. I let down my best friend at an hour he needed me most. My name's Thomas, and I'm racked with doubt. Hi, my name's Paul. I'm a Christian killer, and I'm really hard to work with. And yet, every one of these heroes of the faith had these flaws. There was an honesty. And the flaws were not, their accomplishments were not rewards for their flaws, but their flaws were not unrelated to their accomplishments. Because like Paul said, I discovered power was perfected in weakness, and his grace was sufficient for me. And the honesty availed them to the love of God that was constant. And so you read through the scriptures and you discover all these goofy things. Well, you get to the end. When I got to the end that first time, I'm just making all these discoveries. I go, my heavens, it's so different than I conceived. And at the end, here's how it ended. And all the people were gathered before the throne. And they're singing, you know, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive honor and glory and power and dominion and majesty forever and ever. And I go, that's how it ends. Sounds sort of boring to me. Next year, I read through the Bible from cover to cover. Guess what? When I got to the end, they were still doing it. And I thought, wow, what must he be like? The perfected eyes keep their gaze riveted on him because they're so fascinated. What is it about? I don't think it'll be boring at all. I think we'll be overwhelmed. When it says we'll be like him, it doesn't mean we'll be like him in his deity, not like him in his omniscience, not like him in his omnipotence, not rivals for his power. When it says we'll be like him, I think it means we'll be like Christ in his perfected humanity. Sin will finally be eradicated. And all those things that trip us up will no longer be accoutrements to our growth and development as believers. And I just can't wait. I can't wait. I want all the goofy stuff to be purged finally and to be well. But that's going to happen one day. When we get to heaven, what about now? What about now? And this is what that text says. Beloved, now we are children of God. Now. Now here's where the love of God is manifest in that. Now when we're messed up, he still claims us as his children. There's the constancy of his love. How's it work? Two quick illustrations. When our kids were little, we tried to come up with a way to discipline them. And you know, when you have kids, you go to seminars, you read books, you're trying to be a responsible parent, you know, you think you got it all figured out, and then they're born, and you know, you're just absolutely clueless. And then you think you get it kind of figured out with the first one, and then the second one comes, personality's completely different, you got to re-navigate this whole thing, and you're just sort of trying as best you can. Well, my wife and I came up with this plan. We would not discipline them for something we had not told them about first. You know, just willy-nilly discipline them. And our kids were creative because they would always come up with new things that we'd have to tell them about then to put on the discipline list. And then we'd have to decide what kind of discipline would it be. Would it be a timeout where they have to sit in a chair for a few minutes? Or would it be a spanking? Well, if there was ever something they did that would put life and risk at limb of themselves or somebody else, it might be a spanking. And we would always discipline them this way. We would say to them, what did I tell you not to do? Well, you told me not to play in the street, Daddy. And what were you doing? I was playing in the street. And what did I say I would do? You said you'd spank me, Daddy. And then I'd say to them, do you think I love you any less because you played in the street? No, Daddy, you don't love me any less. Is there anything you could ever do that would make me stop loving you? No, Dad, there's nothing I could do that would make you stop loving me. But am I happy you played in the street? No, you're not happy I played in the street, and I'd administer my loving kindness to their hindquarters. And most of the time it went like that. There were times when I over-egged the pudding and did it in a spirit of anger, and it wasn't good, and I had to grow from those things too and ask their forgiveness and whatnot. But most of the time it went like that. And always when I was done disciplining my kids, you know what I would always do afterwards, immediately afterwards? Hug them. I'd take them in my arms and hold them, always, 100% of the time. And I'd hug them till they were happy. And you know what my kids would always do after being disciplined? Go like that for the hug. No problem for my three boys. No problem. I'd take them in my arms, we'd hug, and Then maybe we would sing a little bit, and then maybe I'd tickle them, and when they're happy again, I'd send them on their way. Never dismiss them from your presence. I didn't want that. And I want them to know that they, when they were disciplined by their Heavenly Father, they could go to Him. He wouldn't be dismissive of them. He would be present in their life. His love is ontological. With my daughter, there was a problem. My daughter's gone on. She's got two master's degrees. She's got her doctorate in psychology. I think our family drove her to it. She's got more degrees in Fahrenheit and Celsius put together. But anyway, she would turn around like this for the hug, and here was the problem. Every orifice in her face would have leaked. Her nose would have leaked. Her eyes would have leaked. Her mouth would have drooled. And she's turning around like this with a hug. And I'm stuck with a moral dilemma. I want to say to her, Alicia, I've got that hug for you. But, you know, why don't you go take a shower, kind of clean up a little bit. You come back here and I'll have that hug all set for you. Can't do that. I'd take her in my arms. And she'd put her head on my shoulder and leave evidence of her DNA all over my clothes. And you know what I discovered? Every father who loves his child bears the stain because he loves the child. That's what we get from that text. Another image. When we were going through the childbearing years, I was a youth pastor, a college pastor. My wife was a stay-at-home mom, and we lived on a very limited income. And my wife didn't like maternity clothes. They didn't sell maternity clothes in cutesy maternity shops back then. They were always in some back corner of some department store. Like, the store was a shame they even had clothes like that for sale. And she had a couple of outfits, and there were some other women going through that same phase of life that had a couple of those outfits, and this wardrobe sort of went around the church. I remember one time, the old college church sanctuary, I saw this blonde-haired woman, and I came up and put my arm around her, and I looked over, it wasn't my wife. She was in my wife's clothes, but it wasn't her. So anyway, Claudia hated those clothes, and so we always made an arrangement that when the child was born, and she could finally get out of those maternity clothes, she could go buy two new outfits. We'd save up. Have you ever seen a new mother with a new baby and new clothes where the new clothes and the new baby are in any way compatible? No. The mother nurses the baby. She puts a diaper on her shoulders to burp the baby. She puts the baby's face right in the diaper. Does the baby hit the diaper? No. She doesn't. The child doesn't. But every mother who loves her child bears a stain because she loves this child. Do you see how great that love is? Do you see how it opens a door to honesty and humility? An honest assessment about things? You will not be abandoned. He loves you. He may discipline you because He doesn't want you to stay in the state of your brokenness. But that text goes on in verse 3 to say, everyone who has this hope fixed upon Him purifies himself just as He is pure. My father was a Marine during World War II. Did any of you ever see the movie Saving Private Ryan? Okay, well, that D-Day invasion that they show at the beginning, I was with my father when we watched that. He was in three of those in the South Pacific, three D-Day invasions. He was in the first wave at Tarawa, the bloodiest battle of World War I for loss of life and real estate gained. There were 5,000 Marines who went in the first assault, 15,000 in all, 30,000 in all, to take an island the size of the parking lot of the Pentagon. They misjudged the tides. The beach he went in and 1,500 went in. They misjudged the tides and a lot of the Marines drowned on the reef. He said they ended up, it took them 4 hours to get from where they were dropped off to the shore. And they came in, there was a pier with machine gun pillboxes here. There was a bunker firing on them. And there was a wharf over here and they were firing on them. They went into a U of fire. It took them 4 hours to get to the beach, and of the 1,500, they were reduced to 200. He was the one that was given the flamethrower with seven other Marines, eight in all, to take out the bunker. The other seven were killed, and he was the one who took out the bunker. I said, what did you think when you heard those screams? And his response was amazing to me. He was a good man. He said, I thought there were mothers in Japan who wouldn't be getting letters from those boys anymore. That presence of mind, even in the midst of such horror. He was a hero. He was highly decorated. He was in the second wave at Saipan and the first wave again at Tarawa. And he was horribly wounded, and he struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder. He struggled with OCD and stuff like that. But he was a good man and a kind man. I never heard him say one negative word about the Japanese, ever in his life. He said they were doing what their people told them to do, we were doing what our people told us to do, and he had high respect for them. He's a good man. But he was of the old guard. He was strong. My younger brother and I both used to bench press 400 pounds, I don't know what that is in kilos, and we both were athletes, you have to take it by faith now. We played sports, we were at a family picnic, and my dad threw water balloons at us. So we took off after him. He outran us for about 50 yards. He didn't have much endurance, so he turns around and he grabbed my brother and I. My brother was an All-American football player. He grabbed us both and threw us on the ground. And we said, boy, Dad, would you like some more fried chicken? And can we get you some potato salad? Or what can we do to serve you? I mean, he was a tough guy, a strong guy. But he was of the old guard. He never once, that I remember in my childhood, said he loved us. I had no doubt about it. He was so present in our life. But I never heard him say it. I was a sophomore in college, and he came up, and he put his arm around me, and he said to me, Jerry, I love you. So out of character of him. So how did I respond? You know. I said, Dad, I love you too. My eyes welled with tears. We never after that finished a conversation where we didn't tell each other we loved each other. And I found myself on weekends when I wasn't playing sports, coming home from college to help him mow the lawn, rake the leaves, wash his car. And I remember in that time, coming home and doing those things for him, to serve him in some way, I was doing it because I wanted to show him I loved him. But I realized I could have come home not knowing he loved me and raked the leaves and mowed the lawn and washed the car to try and get him to love me. Same action, but an eternal difference in attitude, you see. And so I think, again, the awareness of God's love leads us to, I think, the humility and honesty of what our Christian behavior should be. It should be rooted in the love of God and develop from there. If humility and the love of God should be considered in concert with each other, then we have to recognize also that fallen as we are, and like the heroes of the Bible, we can have our moments of stumbling. How do we then begin to cultivate the minimization of real screwing up? And I think when you look at Jesus' statement in Mark 12, 28 through 34, and he's asked, what's the greatest commandment? What's the greatest thing I can do in my life? He says, love God, love your neighbor. How can I then begin to ask diagnostic questions that will begin to catch me before I drift too far? And over the years, I've come up with some diagnostic questions that help me. And I'm going to give them to you, not for you to adopt them. I'm going to give them to you as just an example, and then you think about this and come up with your own questions. And every once in a while, I'll talk with somebody, and they'll say, well, if you're going to have five, maybe I'll get 55 or 505. And I go, no, you should get to a therapist and figure out your obsessive compulsive behavior. You only need about 3 to 5 questions. Think about those areas where you may have a propensity to drift. And because you want to stay on task with the love of God, what questions could you ask that could catch you before you would drift? So you stay in the love of God. There's some humility and honesty that's required of you here. And here are my 5 questions. I've got 4, but I'm thinking about adding this 5th one. So the first one I have to contextualize. In my wild days before I became a Christian, I never got mixed up with women. I had a girlfriend when I was a sophomore in high school, and she dumped me for an older guy. And he took advantage of her and hurt her deeply, and it messed up her life. And I saw that, and I said, that is wrong when men do that stuff to women. And I avoided that stuff. I don't want you in any way to think I was a paragon of virtue. I wasn't. I was a violent person. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I used to take a gun to school. But I'm an American, so you guys think all Americans take guns everywhere they go, right? No, I would take a gun to school. My mother found the gun loaded between my mattresses. Thought it was a starter pistol for track and field. She's looking at this thing, and she pulls the trigger and blows a hole through the mattress, and the bullet lands on the floor of the house. I mean, I was so messed up. So messed up. So I never got mixed up with women. I become a Christian, and that caused me to want to be pure all the more. But I was like any other red-blooded American male. I was looking forward to the day I would get married. But always, I would imagine it would go something like this. I would meet the woman. We would go, I'd ask her out, and of course she'd say, of course, I'd want to go out with you. Whenever I imagined it, that's how it worked, you know. And we would date, and she'd fall madly in love with me. Of course, that's the way it was going to work, in my imagination anyway. And then there would come the time when I'd want to ask her to marry me. I'd go talk to her father to see if that was okay. And he'd say, are you kidding? You're the young man I've been praying for all my life to marry my daughter. Always in my imagination, it went like that. I'd ask her to marry me, and she would say, yeah, and do a few backflips and all that stuff. And then we'd plan our marriage together. And then there would come the day for the wedding. And when I would imagine it, it always went like this. I'd be standing up in the front of the church with my brothers and my brother-in-law and my best friends. And I would see my bride come down the aisle with her father. And the pastor would ask, who gives this woman to be married to this man? And he would say, her mother and I do. And then we would join hands, and he would take us through our vows, and we'd commit our lives together, and he'd pronounce us husband and wife, and then he would introduce us as the new bride and groom. And all of our friends would cheer and be happy, and we would start out the aisle of that church as the organ was swelling and our friends were applauding. And it was always in my imagination, at that moment, Jesus would come back, and it used to bum me out. And it was in that context I came up with my first question. If Jesus came back this minute, would I be disappointed? If Jesus came back this minute, would I be disappointed? Because there was something I was looking forward to, that his coming back would be an interruption rather than a welcome coming. And if you ask yourself the question and something comes up on the radar screen of your mind, it doesn't mean you're unspiritual. Matter of fact, it means that because you asked the diagnostic question, you were able to pull out those things that could become a distraction if you weren't addressing them now. And you don't have to beat yourself up. You just have to work on that. Maybe bring in some confidence with some friends and talk with them and pray about it so that your heart gets to the place where you'd say, Jesus, there is nothing, even the best things you have to offer in this life, there is nothing I would want more than you. And as we begin to understand his love more and more. Second question is a flip side of the first one. Just like I had to tell you the story before I asked you the first question, the second question, I'm going to just give it to you straight up. For me, it was, can I say thank you to God in the midst of any circumstance? Can I say thank you to God in the midst of any circumstance? The circumstances may be totally stinky. Maybe I'm in a situation that feels very Job-like. But can I come to the place where I can say, Lord, if my whole world is falling apart, but I have you, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. And if I can't say thank you, I'm not saying you have to say thank you for the circumstances, but thank you that you have God. Because if we're in a world where moth and rust, the things that we tethered our heart to are the things moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, and that's destroying us, then we've tethered our hearts to things temporal, not things immortal and eternal. James says, every perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation and shifting shadow. Those perfect gifts may awaken desire and longing, but those perfect gifts can't satisfy. Only God can. So if I can't say thank you, it doesn't mean I'm unspiritual. It just means, having asked that question, I'm beginning to see that my mind's drifting. Lord, it's not you that is my fulfillment, but having good circumstances is my fulfillment. Third question, am I out of sorts with anybody? Is there a broken relationship that I'm responsible for? 1 John 4:20, how can we say we love God and we haven't seen if we don't love our brother whom we have seen? And I'm not talking about the relationships where you've done all you can to make it work and the other person's unresponsive to you. I'm talking instead about the relationships where you hold all the cards. You're responsible for the break, and you haven't done anything to fix it. The scriptures say your love for God is at risk of growing cold in that situation, and you need to go set it right. Fourth question, I imagine Jesus talking to me like he talked to Peter at the Sea of Galilee after he raised from the dead. Peter had denied Jesus 3 times. I've denied Jesus before. And I imagine him looking me in the eye, like he looked Peter in the eye, and just saying to me frankly, Jerry, do you love me? If you know the text in the original, Jesus says, Peter, do you agapao me? Do you love me? Agape, with a love that is so charitable and giving, it's a love that's commensurate with my love for you. Peter, do you love me? Peter responds and says, Lord, I like you a lot. He uses the word phileo. We're good friends. It's amazing to me that at that moment, Jesus says, well, if that's the best you could do, Peter, go take a hike. When you can get your act together and love me with the love that's commensurate with mine, you could be my disciple. No, he accepts him on the level of love he can give at that moment. His love is unconditional. And not only that, he even commissions him into ministry. He says, feed my sheep. He doesn't commission him into ministry by virtue of the accomplishments he's had. He commissions him into ministry by virtue of his devotion. And it's not perfect devotion. That's remarkable stuff. He says to him a second time, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, Lord, I like you a lot. And Jesus says, tend my lambs. Third time he says, Peter, do you like me a lot? He uses Peter's word. Peter says, Lord, you know all things. You know I like you a lot. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. Sometimes I don't know if I can even rise to the level of Peter's, Lord, I like you a lot. Sometimes the best I can do is, Lord, I want to love you. Or, Lord, I want to love you. But he's so patient with us. And he loves us so deeply, with a love that's unconditional, that when we pray, Lord, I want to love you, he bumps it up to, Lord, I want to love you. When we pray, Lord, I want to love you, he bumps it up to, Lord, I like you a lot. And in those special moments, we find our hearts soaring. We say, oh, Lord, I love you. I love you. There's honesty in that. There's some humility in that. Fifth question, real quick, because we're running out of time, is I'm toying with this one. Is there some area where I am unwilling to obey? Is there some area where I'm unwilling to obey? Four times in the Upper Room Discourse, Jesus says, if you love me, obey me. So if I fail to obey, maybe my love is growing cold. In 1 John, John also writes about five times connecting love to obedience. I think that's significant. Well, anyway, I think we're done.